Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns over the air and online at koacountry1077.com and at lava1053.com. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha, good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. We're here Sundays at 6:30 a.m. on Koa Country 107.7 FM and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. Today I'm talking with Senator Brian Schatz, who's one of our two United States Senators. Senator Schatz was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and moved to Hawaii when he was two with his dad and mom. And in fact, I'll be asking Senator Schatz a little bit later a question about his dad, who was a doctor. Senator Schatz went to Punahou and got his undergraduate degree in philosophy from Pomona College. He has taught, worked in the nonprofit sector, and then Senator Schatz served in the Hawaii House of Representatives, was chairman of the Democratic Party of Hawaii, served as lieutenant governor, and then was appointed to serve out the late Daniel Inouye's U.S. Senate term. And then he was elected to the U.S. Senate seat in 2014. Good morning. Aloha, Senator Schatz.
Aloha. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here, and I have to tell everybody, we're at Nani Mau Gardens in Hilo, and I just heard you talk to the Hawaii Island Chamber of Commerce. And one thing that really intrigued me was you, number one, are very excited about the job that you're doing in the U.S. Senate, but you also seem to be taking a bit of an intellectual approach. You talked about some of the readings you've been doing. Just talk a little bit about that, because I kind of like that approach, that you're not just bull in a china shop in there.
Well, I am really enjoying the work, and over the last 6 to 8 months, I've been focusing on building bipartisan relationships, and part of that process was to try to find the right models in terms of other U.S. senators who had firmly held beliefs, who represented Democratic states, but who were bipartisan collaborators nonetheless. And so I've been reading a lot about Ted Kennedy and Daniel Patrick Moynihan from the state of New York. And both of them, you know, had their firmly held beliefs, as I do. And when it was necessary to engage in a fight, they would do so. But they also went out of their way to find bipartisan dance partners. And that's what I've been trying to focus on over the last 6 to 8 months, because there are certainly areas where it's going to have to be a battle on the floor and in committee. But there are also some good opportunities for us to work together on infrastructure, on healthcare and technology. Even in the foreign policy space, I think there's still room for bipartisanship.
Well, I know that was one thing when I was very privileged to interview your predecessor, Senator Daniel Kaneohe, that he really stressed that you can't do it alone. You have to get bipartisan knowledge, support, friends.
That's absolutely true. You know, it's more true in the U.S. Senate than any other place, because you have to get to 60 votes, which means you need a combination of Democrats and Republicans to support your legislation. And so over the last 6 months, I've introduced 20 bipartisan pieces of legislation ranging from tourism to telehealth, tsunami preparedness, regional weather forecasting. Every opportunity I have to work with a sort of unlikely partner, I try to avail myself of it. And I think I've even surprised some Republican colleagues of mine, because they know me as a liberal, and that's all true. But I'm trying to demonstrate through my actions that I'm interested in collaborating. And there may be moments where we've got to have a fight, but I think 90% of the time ought to be focused on finding common ground.
Senator Schatz, our late Senator Daniel Kaneohe was on what is considered to be the most powerful committee in the Senate, the Appropriations Committee. And I found it, I won't say surprising, but it was like a wow, you are on the Appropriations Committee. Talk about that. How did that come about? Because that is quite a coup for you and for our state.
Well, it's really good news for Hawaii. One of the main jobs of someone in the U.S. Senate is to make sure that federal resources are spent in Hawaii. And I really understand how much we depend on federal investment on the defense side, on the transportation side, even in the Department of Education and the higher and lower education side. And so, you know, we need to make sure that we're watching those federal dollars and maximizing those federal dollars. So I was appointed to the Appropriations Committee, and I'm also on the right subcommittees. You know, there are 12 individual subcommittees, and I really wanted to try to get on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, the Labor HHS Subcommittee, and Military Construction. And I got on all the subcommittees that I requested. And so we're in a strong position to try to make sure that the federal investment that we've seen over the years and the federal investment that we need over the coming years continues to come. We're going to have our challenges. We're not going to win every battle, but so far, so good.
Senator Schatz, when I told folks I was going to be having the opportunity to talk with you, I got lots of questions from people about specific things. And the first thing I want to ask you about has to do with Kona International Airport and the whole issue of customs. There's been talk that the customs issue for Kona International Airport relative to Japanese travel may be able to be solved by putting customs clearance, pre-clearance at Narita Airport, but a lot of folks here are not convinced that'll happen because the Japanese have to put up money and agree to that. So two aspects of the question. The first is, what about preclearance at Narita? What do you know about it? And is it likely it'll happen?
There are really two ways to approach maximizing international travel at Kona Airport. The first is what you talked about. Preclearance at Narita, Customs and Border Protection, at my request, was focusing on certain international airports for preclearance, and they identified Narita as one of them. It's great news. But you're also right in understanding that it requires a facility to be built on the Narita side, so that's not an instantaneous thing. The other point to be made about this is that even when it happens, you're still only talking about preclearance from Narita. It's not Tokyo, it's not Sapporo, it's not the Philippines, it's just Narita. And so it would be helpful, but not quite a game changer. The real game changer is to be able to actually process and have a proper Customs and Border Protection facility at Kona Airport. There are a couple of challenges there. One is we're going to need some additional state investment. We've been in conversations with both Hawaii Tourism Authority and Governor Ige's office and his Department of Transportation to try to make sure that they're serious about that. Mike McCartney, the Chief of Staff, knows everything about this, having been the former Executive Director of Hawaii Tourism Authority. The other thing that we were able to do is that tent, you know, it's really a sprung structure in the lava field. The Customs and Border Protection people feel that it's not up to spec. And we put language in the appropriations bill having to do with transportation and HUD, allowing sprung structures to meet the specifications. So that if we're able to staff it and if we're able to work with the San Francisco Customs and Border Protection folks, then we think that that facility will suffice, which will allow us to move a lot quicker and a lot more cheaply to get more and more people processed to Kona.
I know as a senator from the state, you can't really pick and choose between islands, but I understand that Maui is also lobbying heavily to have them be the second port of customs entry into the state, because that's another benefit to the state. If something ever happens to Honolulu Airport or Honolulu Customs, then our state has no customs capability. But what's your sense as to whether it could be Maui or Kona?
This may sound political, but actually it should be both. It really should. The demand is there. And it would be one thing if there were kind of light demand and we were trying to squeeze a few more routes, and then we might have to make a choice between Kona and Kahului. I don't think we do. I think the question is infrastructure. First of all, you have to build the physical infrastructure that meets the specifications, and then you got to staff it with Customs and Border Protection agents who live on island and can go through the process and keep everybody safe. So I actually think we have plenty of demand, especially in the Asia Pacific region, for several international airports and Customs and Border Protection facilities.
So you're going for both?
We're going to try for both, but I will tell you that I think the Kona process is a little further along, and Hawaii Tourism Authority and the Governor's Office and DOT, I think, are a little further along with Kona than they are with Kahului.
One of the things you spoke about was funding for tsunami preparedness, et cetera. And clearly, Senator Schatz, you know how subject Hawaii Island is to natural disasters. You yourself were here for Hurricane Azelle, which actually was technically a tropical storm by the time it devastated Puna. Prior to that, in 2011, we had the Kona side of the island really devastated by a tsunami, even though everything, of course, was overshadowed by the horrible destruction in Japan. This year, we've had more tropical storms than ever before. The concern is federal funding that we sometimes need to help for two things. One is Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. They always get concerned when the government decides to do a shutdown, which some people in the government seem to think is a great idea. We're also concerned about having adequate FEMA funds for when we do need help. Give us your comments on that whole topic.
Well, first of all, I do not think there should be, and nor do I think there will be, a government shutdown this fall. There are some radicals in primarily the House of Representatives, but a couple of people like Ted Cruz in the Senate and a handful of others who are trying to shut the government down in order to reduce by $500 million the appropriation that ends up in women's health clinics. And I think that is unwise. I think that's bad for the country. And I think it's no way to govern. I also think it won't happen, because although I disagree with Mitch McConnell on many, many things, we're in agreement that government shutdowns are bad for the country. They're bad for everybody. If there were any kind of disruption in funding, FEMA is always there. It's considered an essential service. So in the case that there were something that happened to Hawaii Island or the state of Hawaii, FEMA is always going to be there. But you're right, there's an increasing frequency and severity of natural disasters, partly caused by climate change, and we need to recognize that reality and make sure that the funding for the relief agencies and disaster response agencies is there, and that's one of the things that I focus on as an appropriator.
Senator Schatz, recently I had the privilege of attending a statewide attorneys conference, and I heard one attorney talk about, the title of his talk was Federal Incursion into State and County Matters. Mm-hmm. And he was specifically talking about Department of Interior, the Fish and Wildlife, declaring so many thousands of acres as critical habitat, and the National Park Service wanting to declare Keauhou Aquifer as a managed groundwater area, despite hydrologists, even their own, saying there's not a problem. What can you do as our United States Senator to help sort of stop what appears to be an assault on the state and certainly on this island, according to all the experts with whom I've spoken?
Well, this is really becoming a challenge for us with federal, especially conservation-related agencies, declaring things that are not true and not based on science. I mean, to designate basically all of Kona for a time to be critical habitat totally dismantled the Kona Community Development Plan. I mean, they decided that the site for the Kona Courthouse was critical habitat, and that just flies in the face of common sense. We really pushed for a mediation process whereby most of that got settled. There's only one parcel that's still in sort of a dispute, but 95% of the land and the landowners are satisfied, and the mediation process actually worked. On the Keauhou Aquifer, you got it exactly right. There is no hydrological reason to designate Keauhou Aquifer in that way. And, you know, I'm a science person. I'm out there on the Senate floor talking, criticizing Republicans for not paying attention to the science when it comes to climate. And so I think it's incumbent on me to be consistent. And even though I think the folks at DOI are trying to do the right thing in terms of the resource, they got to have the science behind them, and they just don't. You're right. The state water resource experts, the federal water resource experts, nobody really thinks the Keauhou Aquifer needs this level of management, and it's going to dismantle our ability to have appropriate development in the Kona area. The Commission on Water Resource Management is a state agency, and they have the final say. So on this one, it's not a federal decision, it's a federal recommendation. And I'm quite confident that the Commission on Water Resource Management will continue to, you know, manage the resource appropriately, but not shut down what everybody seems to think is the right kind of development in Kona.
You mentioned federal influence. What are you doing to influence that particular decision, the Keauhou Aquifer, if such a thing can be influenced? Not the decision, because you can't influence the state, but you certainly can influence a little bit the Department of Interior, the National Park Service.
We are in an ongoing dialogue with DOI at the sort of line level and all the way up to the assistant secretaries and the secretaries about this. They know that we are watching, we are deeply concerned, and we're unhappy. This is not the right way to do conservation. I grew up in conservation. I'm still passionate about conservation, and I'm probably one of the U.S. senators who cares the most, especially on the appropriation side, in terms of making sure that these agencies get the resources that they need to take care of our natural resources. But in exchange for all of that, I want them to actually listen to communities. And there are plenty of environmentally special and culturally significant areas in the state of Hawaii that need federal investment. Them meddling in state and county water issues is just not useful to anybody.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. Next Sunday, we start the first of three interviews about energy transformation on Hawaii Island. My guest next Sunday will be Eric Gleason, the president of NextEra Energy Transmission. As you know, NextEra wants to buy Hawaiian Electric Industries. And Jay Ignacio, the president of Helco, to find out what the NextEra plan is. Then September 20th and 27th, we'll learn about the existing Kauai Island Utility Cooperative and the proposed Hawaii Island Energy Cooperative with their chief officers. Remember, Island Issues is here every Sunday morning, both on the radio and online, lava1053.com and coacountry1077.com, where you can catch up with the most recent Island Issues interviews. Now let's get back to our conversation with United States Senator Brian Schatz. Senator Schatz, there was a recent article in Civil Beat talking about you and Senator Martin Heinrich of New Mexico and Chris Murphy of Connecticut as thought leaders in foreign policy. And it was an interesting quote in Civil Beat. Of the three, it is Schatz who shows up as the most nimble and interesting as a speaker, deeply familiar with facts, but thoughtful and at turns humorous. So first, that was really a kind of a cool comment.
Well, that's very nice of them.
Can you give us a thumbnail? I don't want to have great detail on your 8-point foreign policy, but I do urge people to Google and you can get your whole article in Foreign Policy magazine. But what are the key issues of your 8-point foreign policy plan?
Well, I think it's pretty straightforward. You know, what has happened over the last several years is that the people who speak on foreign policy, in fact, on behalf of the country overseas, tend to be John McCain and Lindsey Graham. And I actually was surprised a little bit once I got to personally know them. I really like John McCain and Lindsey Graham, but I don't think they represent the mainstream of American thinking when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, they are very, let's call it leaning in when it comes to military action. And what Martin and Chris and a couple of others who are working on these issues think is that, you know, nuance is okay. Thinking through the consequences of a military action is okay. And that we ought to explore diplomacy as aggressively as we possibly can. And what we really wanted to do is establish a sort of center-left foreign policy that articulates an inclination towards collaboration, an inclination towards working with other countries, a disposition towards diplomacy without being totally allergic to military engagement when necessary. In other words, we're not the new peace movement, but we think there's plenty of room in between, say, John McCain and Bernie Sanders, and that's the space that we're beginning to occupy.
Senator, the plan does not seem to talk much about economic collaboration, which generally is a big part of foreign policy. Now, one example we have on Hawaii Island of international collaboration is the 30-meter telescope, which is a scientific and economic collaboration. How does that kind of project, TMT or other similar projects, how does that fit into your foreign policy thinking?
Well, I think scientific collaboration really is part of how we can establish better relationships with both our friends and our adversaries. I mean, one of the things that's happening in the Asia-Pacific region that is a positive development is that there are the kinds of partnerships that are very difficult to disentangle should we find ourselves in a tough situation where military action might be considered. And so, to me, the more cultural engagement, the more economic engagement, the more educational exchanges that we can establish, the more tourism, the more joint ventures on the private sector side, the less likely that we end up in some sort of kinetic engagement. And, you know, Admiral Sam Locklear, the last PACOM commander, said, if we find ourselves in kinetic engagement, which is a euphemism for war, it represents a failure of the Asia-Pacific strategy. I mean, think how important that is, that the PACOM commander, the person in charge of what would be a warfighting plan should it become necessary, is the person saying, if we get to war, it means our strategy failed. And if we see what's happening in the Asia-Pacific region, one of the things that I want to focus on as an appropriator is to make sure that we continue to get the investment in Hawaii and the Asia-Pacific region, and that we don't punish PACOM for being successful in preventing wars, because the other component commands are getting political attention, intellectual attention, and as a result, they get appropriations, they get money. But they get money because the region is on fire. PACOM, that region, is actually being managed relatively well. We have our challenges in the Spratly Islands, we have our challenges with North Korea, but relative to what's happening in the other component commands, we're doing well. And to me, that means they should get more investments, more resources, rather than fewer.
One of the things you briefly spoke about today at the Hawaii Island Chamber Lunch was continued military funding for the state, that you expect there to be more, not less.
That's right. The Navy is absolutely committed to the state of Hawaii, the Marines and the Air Force. I think the Army is a little bit more of a challenge because if we move forward with sequestration, which we should not, there would be a required end strength reduction of about 20,000 Army soldiers nationwide. The last round of cuts, remember, the possibility that was raised was that Schofield Barracks would be eliminated. The only way that that would have happened is if the entire force reduction for the entire army were born on the island of Oahu. So that was never really very seriously in the cards. But that's not to say that the army is not facing difficult fiscal challenges and that we don't face, you know, modifications of troop numbers and soldier numbers. But in the overall picture, there's an increase in military construction in the state of Hawaii. There's an increased investment on the Navy, Marines, and Air Force side. We just announced a $20 million partnership with DBED and the High Technology Development Corporation, where the Air Force Energy Lab is actually going to do a series of microgrids and do renewable energy testing. $20 million for the state of Hawaii for renewable energy through the Air Force. The Office of Naval Research is doing pretty much a similar project called SPIDERS on the island of Oahu. So you're talking about $40 million in a relatively short period of time just spent on clean energy in Hawaii just from the Department of Defense. So I'm quite hopeful. We have tremendous challenges, but we're also well positioned.
Senator, I got several questions from people in the boating community because apparently there's some lack of happiness with how things are going relative to the Coast Guard. And I understand that you are on a committee that can actually deal with this. So let me tell you what the two concerns are. One is, obviously, you know that ocean recreation and commercial boating here is absolutely key important. But vessel registration is in the hands of the Coast Guard. They closed their Seattle office and they moved everything to a contractor in Washington, D.C. And what I'm hearing from the boating community is it takes not days, sometimes weeks, sometimes longer to get the registration changed. The subcontractor back in Washington sometimes has a fax machine that doesn't work. Sometimes they don't answer calls, which is, of course, understanding. They're closed at 11 in the morning for us. What can you do to help this happen faster? Because clearly transferring commercial registration is absolutely critical.
This is something that we're aware of and we just found out about it. We've communicated to the Coast Guard in the Pacific about this challenge and we hope to be able to follow up with the individual boaters. But this seems to me to be an eminently fixable problem. To make sure that boaters are able to re-register their vessels is very basic, and it's a Coast Guard requirement, so their end of the bargain on the Coast Guard side should be that they do things with a reasonable pace.
The other issue has to do with the Coast Guard certifying boats as they get built. And as you know, because of the Jones Act, the boats have to be built, if they're commercial use boats, have to be built in the United States. And what I'm being told is the certification process is slow and cumbersome. There's not good communication. So talk about that.
This is the first I'm hearing about this, but I'm happy to follow up on it. But it sounds like it's in the same category of if the Coast Guard is going to require certain things of boaters, again, their end of the bargain should be at least to process the paperwork in a timely fashion.
You know, being in Hawaii is a wonderful thing because I kind of like being far away from Washington, but it's not always good for all aspects of business, is it?
That's right. It's a real challenge. And, you know, part of my job is to make sure that we have that connectivity. It's 6-hour time difference most of the time. It's 5,000 miles. And so we work really hard on making sure that our legislative staff, about half of whom are from Hawaii up in Washington, D.C., but that all of them get a chance to interact with folks in Hawaii. They fly here. They travel around, they meet with folks. We want them to know the difference between, you know, Kona and Kahului and Lihue and Laupahoehoe, and that takes time on the ground. So we want to make sure that all of our staff, the folks who are from Hawaii and the folks who are from other places, spend as much time in Hawaii as possible.
Well, it was actually really fun when I called your office to follow up on this interview. The young person who answered the phone is from Oahu but has family on the Big Island and wanted to tell me all about it. I just thought that was really very sweet and nice.
Yeah, we've got just an extraordinary staff. I've never been so pleased with any staff that's ever worked for me and with me. And they're just an outstanding bunch of folks and they're dedicated to public service. So it's a pleasure to work with them.
You have spoken now of support for the Iran deal that was worked out by John Kerry and several foreign countries. It looks like now there is sufficient support to uphold that agreement. Today at the Hawaii Island Chamber of Commerce luncheon, you gave a brief explanation of that, and I'd like you to share that with the listeners.
Well, first of all, most people who work in nonproliferation, most experts in the area of containing or constraining nuclear ambitions of either nuclear threshold states or nuclear states, agree that this is actually, as an agreement, it's a good agreement, which is different from saying that we trust Iran or different from saying that we got everything we wanted in it. It's just that when we were kind of discussing the realistic range of possibilities when it came to an agreement like this, this is on the very, very high end of achievement. A person who used to chair the organization opposing the Iran deal actually quit the organization because after having read it and after having briefings about it, decided he was in favor of it. I mean, this is the person who was the chair of the so-called Citizens for a Nuclear-Free Iran, and he quit because he actually now supports the deal. The other part of this equation has to do with what would actually happen as a practical matter if we dump the deal. Here's what would happen. The international sanctions would fall apart, and as a practical matter, that means that Iran would get their money whether we like it or not, and they would be under no obligation under international law to follow through on the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. So basically, here's the choice. Either we eliminate 98% of their nuclear material, in exchange for which they get the $56 billion out of Chinese, French, and Russian bank accounts, or the alternative is they get their $56 billion and their nuclear program too. I don't want them to have their nuclear program. I think this is a good deal, which is different from saying that I think it will certainly work. We don't know whether it will work, and we certainly walk into any agreement believing that we cannot trust Iran. We should take them seriously when they say death to America. But my view is, do you want your greatest geopolitical adversary in the region to be a nuclear threshold state, or do you want to have 15 years without them having access to the bomb?
Some of the people in Congress have said they want a, quote, better deal. Have any of them shared with you what they actually mean by better deal?
Well, you know, anyone can look at the deal and improve upon it just by sort of, you know, deleting certain sections and improving on certain sections. But you would have to negotiate that deal, and you'd have to negotiate that deal with the P5 plus one, with the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, and others. And what has been extremely clear and clearly communicated by the P5 plus one ambassadors is that if we dump this deal, they are going to vacate and we will be alone again. And that sounds okay. I mean, you know, unilateral tough sanctions is sort of satisfying on a instinctive level. It sounds good. Why don't we just go it alone and be hard-nosed with Iran? Remember, we had unilateral sanctions and they had 165 centrifuges. And then they went up to 18,000 centrifuges. Unilateral sanctions were never enough, and it was only when we were able to stitch together a true international coalition did it bring Iran to the negotiating table.
Thank you for your clarification, because I think it's really helpful, because I think a lot of the media has not been very clear about what this is and what the consequences are if we don't do it.
Well, I think part of what went on is that if you ask a person whether they trust Iran, they will say no. If you ask a person if they stand with Israel, they will say yes. If you ask a person whether you want to sort of open up new relations with a country that chants death to America, of course, everyone's instinct is going to be, why would we make a deal with these guys? They're our enemy. And that's, I think, an appropriate instinct. But if you take a deep breath, you read the deal, you listen to the expertise, you find that this is a pretty good, narrowly constructed deal. It doesn't change the way we deal with Iran when it comes to their state sponsoring of terrorism, the havoc that they're wreaking in Yemen, or our basic disposition against them in the region. It just takes the nuclear issue off the table.
Senator Schatz, your 8-point foreign policy plan includes provisions about civil rights and human rights, and that really leads me to your father, Erwin Schatz. First of all, I want to say I'm sorry. I know you lost your dad this year, and having lost my own dad, I know it's really tough. So, sympathies.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your dad did something remarkable. He was a cardiologist, but when he was a very young doctor, he took a very bold move relative to, I'd have to say, both human rights and civil rights, relative to some medical experiments that were going on. Tell us what he did.
There was something by the United States Public Health Service called the Tuskegee Experiment on African American men. And what they did was they had a group of African American men, and they knew that penicillin would cure syphilis. And they had two groups, one that they gave the medicine to and one where they allowed the disease to develop, to see what would happen as syphilis progresses in humans. And that's obviously immoral and unethical. And shocking that the United States government actually did that, and not 100 years ago, not 50 years ago, but just a few decades ago. And my dad was the only doctor at the time to go on the record writing a letter to the U.S. Public Health Service telling them to stop. And the result a couple of years later, as there were additional whistleblowers, was that Congress actually passed legislation to ban essentially experimenting on human beings. And, you know, it taught me a couple of things. First, always do the right thing, but what I remember about this is that I didn't even know he had done any of this until I was around 30 years old, that he had done this. And there are so many people who, if they played that role in history and showed that kind of courage in history, would probably go around telling folks about it all the time, writing articles about themselves, writing books, being on talk shows. And he just did the right thing and he moved on, you know. And I'll never be able to achieve what my dad achieved as a professional or as a person, but that idea that you just try to do the right thing and move on, I try to carry with me.
Well, you know, last time I spoke with you, which actually shockingly to me was 2 years ago, meaning a year ago I talked to you in a candidate forum, but the first time you told me that your dad really was strong on that you have to do the right thing no matter what. I read his obituary in the New York Times. Your father was a very prominent man, and that was a remarkable thing he did. So what a legacy.
Well, thank you. And you're giving me a chance to brag on my dad in one other way. The other thing about Dr. Irv Schatz is that you would never know that he was so accomplished. I mean, there were a lot of people who knew him. He was a volunteer at the Honolulu Museum of Art, and he did a bunch of other. He volunteered at Tripler. He flew to Hilo to work at VA almost every week for a long time, once a week, as a volunteer. You know, for such an accomplished guy, a lot of people who get to that level of accomplishment are difficult to approach. And he just wasn't intimidating. You know, he always made people feel comfortable. And I think about the way he just conducted himself personally. Forget the professional stuff. Just being kind to people is worth paying attention to.
Senator Schatz, what else do you want to mention that I haven't asked you about today, because we're at the end of our time together?
Well, my focus over the next year and a half is going to be on bipartisan legislation and then the appropriations process. You know, I understand Hawaii Island has really unique needs in the harbors and the transportation systems. Hilo has incredible opportunities, but the airports need help. And the National Park Service play an incredible role in our community here and the economy here. And so my focus is going to be to try to get those appropriations bills moving and make sure that we have the funding that we need to keep our economy going.
Senator Schatz, how can your constituents get a hold of you or your staff if they need help?
The best way is to go to schatz.senate.gov. We have a web form which you can fill out. It's very simple, and I assure you it's not a black hole. It actually goes right to a staff person who will look at your email and find the appropriate person to respond. So schatz.senate.gov.
Thank you so much, Senator Brian Schatz. Aloha.
Aloha. Thank you.
And to our listeners, thank you so much for being with us. This is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. We recorded our interview with Senator Brian Schatz last Thursday in Hilo. I'll see you next Sunday morning for another Island Issues when we start the first of three interviews dealing with Hawaii Island's energy. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us info@lava1053.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Island's Mahalo Multimedia.